Hello, welcome to the Crisis of Civilization podcast, episode 2. I'm Dean Puckett, sitting here in yet another strange little room, actually, with Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed. Today, well, we released the Crisis of Civilization online and on DVD this week, on Wednesday. So you can watch the film at our website, crisisofcivilization.com, and get a DVD and just get involved generally. As a response, we've had a lot of threads and comments and things like that on YouTube and things and Facebook and everything. And one of the things that kept popping up that I thought we could first start talking about today is why we didn't really focus on the issue of population in our movie. So maybe you could just answer that, Nafees.
Yeah, well, the issue of population is something that we've been asked a lot about at screenings. Why is population not mentioned? And for the most part, people who are asking that question feel that population is a kind of a primary cause of a lot of the problems that we have. And the idea is that, you know, the Earth has a limited carrying capacity, and that therefore population growth is kind of breaching that carrying capacity, and that's what's leading us to these crises. Now, I do agree that population growth it does seem like it's kind of getting to this point where we have to start asking ourselves that it's part of this ongoing growth trajectory, which is unsustainable. And I think it's legitimate to kind of ask questions about population and kind of recognize that we can't keep on growing. So I'm totally open to the issue of population. What I've got serious reservations about is the idea that population growth is a fundamental driving cause of the problems that we're facing at the moment. And the reason that is because I analyse population slightly differently to those who do think that it's a driving cause and think that it has to be addressed as a driving cause, and that something needs to be done specifically about population in order for us to get to a point where we're able to deal with these crises. And I think that's basically the wrong way of looking at it. The people who are advocating this idea about population growth being a driver of crises, basically they're kind of looking at it from a very big picture perspective that tends to simplify what's actually happening. So what they tend to argue is that, you know, for example, you look at, if you, for example, have a graph of population growth over the last, say, 200 years, and then you have a graph of energy consumption over the last 200 years, and you put them side by side, both of them seem to kind of pretty much rise up higher and higher and higher exponentially. And that's looking at it from a global scale. So if you look at it globally and over a long period of time, there seems to be, at face value, a correlation between the rise of population and the rise of energy exploitation. So then that leads to this conclusion that, oh, therefore they're linked. Population is driving the other, one of them is driving the other one. So population growth is driving the energy consumption, which is obviously reaching a limit, and we're exploiting our natural resource systems too much, and now it's got to this point where it's unsustainable. Now, the problem with that theory is when you actually start to look at what's happening country by country, it completely breaks down. And what, I mean, any statistician will tell you that just because two lines in a graph tend to be heading in the same direction, there might seem to be a correlation that's not the same as causation. For causation to take place, you actually have to prove it empirically of how the things are caused. And when you start looking into actually how and why this is happening, it starts to break down. That simplistic image doesn't work. What's actually happening, if you look at energy consumption and population growth according to different regions and different countries, what we find is that countries in the north, in the industrialized Western north, which are consuming the bulk of the world's energy, you know, countries like the United States, China, they basically top the list, followed by Western Europe, Japan, Russia, blah, blah, blah. These countries, basically, most all of them, invariably, are suffering from population. The population growth is now tapering off, and in some cases, actually going down. So, actually, what's happening is the population, if you look forward and project, population is going to contract. And when you start looking at the kind of countries, the poorer countries of the world, Africa, South America, South Asia, where we actually find that energy consumption is very, very small because these countries are quite poor, they're not as industrialized. What you find is actually that when their populations are large and are growing very, very fast, and much faster than the North. So you find that actually population is really, really high. Population growth is very, very high. And yet levels of energy consumption are virtually minimum. And when you actually compare them, you compare the amount of energy, say, consumed by Bangladesh, and you compare that to the United States or China or Britain, I mean, you're talking about a huge gulf, like massive, massive gulf. So what that shows is that that analysis completely breaks the argument that there's a causation between population growth and even a correlation, actually, between population growth and energy consumption. I think it's important not to see population growth as a fundamental driver of these crises, but rather to see it as the other way around. Because if what we're seeing is population growth is exponentially increasing in certain poorer countries which are not actually consuming very much energy, and the countries where population is actually decreasing and rates of population growth are almost going negative, and they're yet astronomically consuming vast majority of the world's energy resources and destroying most of a lot of the environment, degrading the soil, and, you know, basically and releasing pollution. And they're doing all of that, and then we're saying that it's all about the too many people in the world. And most of those happen to be in the South, but they're not actually responsible for that. I think that would be an injustice to kind of see it as that. What we need to be looking at is understanding why is it that certain countries are structured in such a way in their relations with other countries, in their relation with the world, that they end up creating this social, political, economic system and cultural system that is very, very high consumerist, which exploits vast amounts of energy that it doesn't need, that wastes so much. Those are systemic issues to do with the way our society is organized, the way our politics is organized, the way our culture is organized, rather than just about population. And what's interesting about that is that the way that structure works in relationship with the structure of these other poorer countries creates this overall momentum where, yeah, you have this overall, certainly there is an overall trajectory of population growth globally, but that is being driven by this systemic deeper issues. And if we want to deal with the way population is interacting in this detrimental way with the environment, we need to look at those specific issues about social organization. How are our societies organized in a way that makes populations behave in ways that are so crazy and don't make any sense? When you get to that issue, then it's like the population thing becomes, it will actually be something we can deal with if we deal with these other issues. And then the population problem will deal with it. I mean, there's a separate debate about the carrying capacity of the Earth and how many people is too much on a global scale for the Earth to deal with. And there's a debate about that, and a lot of people feel that there's an optimal level of, you know, people, there's a debate, people, some people say it's 3 billion, some people say it's 1 billion, some people say that no, but actually if you implement certain measures you can take it up to 11 billion. I don't know what the answer to that is, and I think my view is I'm slightly skeptical of anyone who will just say you can just keep growing population indefinitely. I'm a little bit skeptical of that. I think I don't really see that being justifiable.
But there's something slightly like for me, obviously I edited the film. You spoke a lot. You didn't not speak about population at all, but we made that choice because there's something slightly almost fascist or weird about always focusing too much on population growth when, as you say, all these other issues, essentially if we deal with them and we deal with them in a good way, we can, population will probably sort itself out. Is that fair to say? Kind of.
Well, it depends what will happen. I mean, if we continue on the current trajectory, population will sort itself out in the sense that there are certain large numbers of people who suffer, and if we don't adapt to what's happening, yeah, then mean, they I may mean, they may. I mean, like, we're already seeing that. Yeah. We're already seeing millions of people in the South, predominantly, who are dying and suffering from malnutrition, suffering from. They're the ones taking the brunt of a lot of the erratic weather and the droughts and the crazy crap that's going on. They're already feeling that. But what's interesting, again, it comes back to why people will always say it's about population, there's too many people. But they're not the ones who are exploiting all the energy and eating all the driving this crazy industrial juggernaut and then saying, oh, there's too many people in the world. They're not doing that. They're the ones who are just sitting there trying to, like, get by on a lot less than what we do. And then they're suffering from the brunt of these, obviously indirectly, but systemic effects in terms of the climate system, in terms of energy, in terms of all this stuff, in terms of the economy and the maldistribution of wealth and all that. All of that stuff is affecting the vast majority of people on the planet. And yet the people who are talking about population growth and talking about population specifically as a fundamental problem and emphasize it to the detriment of everything else, they're people who are in the industrialized north, who are living the high life. Yeah. And even though they might be advocating that we should descend, rightly so, in terms of our energy consumption, all the rest of it, but it's a slightly privileged position to be talking about population when we come from, and I'm part of that, we come from a minority of people on the planet who happen to be in the most advanced industrial countries and who happen to be basically primarily responsible for the devastation of the planet through the nature of the global system and its unequal structure. And it's slightly weird for us to be kind of talking about population when we, in terms of population, the people who are responsible systemically and socially are in a minority on the planet, not in a majority. The majority of people are the ones who are suffering, and they're not actually the ones driving the system.
Okay, and that feeds really well into another question I have, which in a lot of Q&As and screenings, and sometimes online now as well, people are saying, like, oh, well, you know, we live in the West, we live in Britain, Europe, America, we've been living the high life, we've got milkshakes, we're driving around, and we've got roller skates and driving movies and popcorn and all these great things that capitalism bring. And now you're saying, well, it's all coming down. And what about the third world? So they're not allowed to have what we've got. How can you say to those guys, you know, you can't have what we've had? That's not fair. You know, they say that. People have said that to us. So how would you respond to that?
Well, the first thing, I think, is to kind of be a little bit self-reflective and sceptical about whether what we've got is really that amazing and really that wonderful and really, are we actually that happy with what we've got? And I think it's all really great to say that we've got cars and roads and popcorn and all that stuff.
Roller skates.
And we kind of have this feeling that, wow, it's so amazing. But you have to remember that that's an ideology that is actually quite explicitly put out subliminally by corporates, by government, that the way we do things is amazing and mind-blowing. And don't question it, because it's just so unquestionably brilliant, and you just really don't need to live any other way, because that's what keeps it going. You have to keep buying and buying and buying and going out and having fun and going to cinema and going out and buying stuff and going out to clubs and this, that, and doing all the stuff that makes people happy, you know, supposedly fun stuff, and live that life 24/7 and work hard and play hard. And that's what people are pushing. That's what corporates and government are pushing, because that's what keeps the system going, and it makes sense, and there's a certain internal logic to it. Everyone buys into it and it seems so great. If you just step back for a little bit, though, we have to ask ourselves that, wait a minute, well, we're caught so much in that, maybe it isn't that great. And if you look at all of the studies that have come out over the last 10 years of how happy we are, as you know, in the UK, in Western Europe, in the US, the studies are pretty clear, empirically, unequivocally, that we're not happy. The vast majority of people in the West are not very happy. And actually, if you look at the correlation between the amount of wealth people have and happiness, the studies show, I mean, there's been people like Oliver James who've done studies of this. There's the new book, The Spirit Level by Richard Wilkinson. And what's definitely clear from the literature is that wealth and this form of industrial wealth hasn't brought happiness. In fact, it's made us really unhappy. So now people are starting to ask this question of, well, if this has made us unhappy, what's so brilliant about it? And I think,
So that brings us on to the second part of the question, right? Which is like, well, okay, let's imagine you have some magic telephone. So you just made it very clear that, you know, we're not as happy as, and our system isn't as brilliant as we might think. Imagine you had some magic telephone and you could pick it up and you could talk to the third world. Hello, third world, whoever that is. And you can tell them, hey, this is the way you should go. What would you say?
I think the development trajectory that they have to go on, I think we've made very clear in the Crisis film and the book that there is a link between the development trajectory of the North and the development trajectory of the South. They're not two separate things. So the poorer countries of the South are poorer because of their relationship, their unequal relationship within the global system with the richer nations of the North. The rich North didn't just get rich by itself in a silo. Its development was linked to the exploitation of the South. And again, there's a huge debate about that. But I think there's a very strong case to be made that, you know, we're looking at the legacy of colonization and imperialism and all the rest of it. So, and that's continued in the international financial structures that we have today. But so that kind of gives us an indication that if we want the South to develop, it has to be a very different form of development from what we've experienced. Because what we've experienced is very exploitative globally. So we have to have in the South something much more grassroots, about grassroots and power. And this is what the message that we're seeing from analysing one of these crises is that there is too much inequality. There is too much kind of concentration of wealth. It's all very focused on material production and consumption. So the values have to shift, and we have to start thinking about how we can, so rather than thinking about subjugating our spiritual well-being to our material desires, this needs to be the other way around. We need to kind of say, yeah, you know, there should be basic, we should meet our basic material needs. But fundamentally, we need to be thinking about what really makes us happy. What really makes us happy are these values of generosity and compassion and being able to actualize ourselves as individuals in community, with other, in a communal relation with other people. And again, there's studies about this which show that, you know, people find themselves happier when they're actualizing themselves. And these ethical values we talk about capture those kinds of behavior. So I think what we're looking at overall for both the North and the South is a model where the North needs to basically descend away from the very exploitative types of socio-economic political organisation that we've had. And the South needs to be able to develop, but not in the form of industrialisation that we've had. But we need to, in a way, they need to kind of jump forward to some of the technologies that industrialization has enabled, really interesting technologies. So I'm not saying that we should allow the South to stay in this Stone Age existence. But now a lot of things are possible through this period of industrialization. A lot of things are now possible that weren't possible before. You know, you can set up a telephone, you can set up a communications infrastructure in the South without having to lay down loads of telephone lines and cables and pylons, which is very, very energy intensive. You can actually just now, because of the internet and what's been enabled through the internet, you can create a really sophisticated communications infrastructure. Without doing that, you spend a lot less money, it's a lot less energy intensive, a lot cleaner. So that's just like an example. So there's a lot of stuff you can do, and obviously looking at what communities can do locally to kind of become more, to become kind of modern and advanced. Well, modern and advanced doesn't have to mean let's set up this massive conglomerate of concrete and stuff like that. No, let's keep it local and keep it beautiful. But you can still rely on renewable energies. You can use solar power and biogas. And biogas is different from biofuels. I'm talking about gas that is created from burning waste, so like human waste or dung, cow dung, stuff like that, you can actually use to create new forms of energy, geothermal energy, wind energy. And there are programs that are going on in different parts of the South already where they've implemented these kind of things locally at village level, at community level. And it's created really exciting opportunities for people. And it's allowed them to organize and mobilize politically and to become producers in their own right. People are now energy producers in their local communities. They now have a state, they have a source of revenue, they're producing food. So I think what we're looking at is a completely different model of development, which is about local grassroots empowerment, which is what we'll see, in a way, we'll see the North becoming more equal and fairer, and we'll see the South becoming more equal and fairer as well. And we'll see more people being lifted out of poverty and more of us over here being less concerned by having so much and much more happy with just being.
So what you're basically saying is it's not like you're trying to deny the global South all the brilliant stuff we've had. You're saying, look at what a mess we've made. You know, do something better, a bit more interesting, a bit more grassroots and healthier all round.
Yeah.
Another one of the big things, you know, as soon as we put the video out, we've got a chapter about climate change. So immediately, obviously, you get all the trolls, all the climate deniers. They're all saying, you know, climate change isn't real. It's a hoax. Blah, 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 blah. Now, I would ask you about that now, but I actually recorded you at length while I was making the Crisis of Civilization, talking in depth, fairly in depth about the climate denial issue. So rather than asking you again now, what I'll do is I'll just play it now in this podcast.
The mainstream assessment amongst scientists is correct, and that, you know, a careful analysis of the literature, of the scientific literature and the debates that are going on in that literature, a careful analysis of the skeptic arguments and the scientific evidence that they try to bring to the table, and a fair analysis of all of that totality of evidence just really, you know, puts the weight of the evidence pointing firmly towards the conclusion that the mainstream conclusion that the vast majority of climate scientists have endorsed, that global warming is, at the moment, is largely anthropogenic, it's being caused by human activities. That is just an unavoidable conclusion, as far as I'm concerned. I would say, though, is that there is a difference between what policymakers have said about climate change, what international institutions have been able to say about climate change, even what the IPCC have said. And I would argue that actually what skeptics are saying is that the IPCC and the policymakers, they're far too alarmist and actually they're wrong. And I would say that the IPCC and policymakers, the position that they've taken may be wrong, but not because they're too alarmist, but because actually they've not taken into account how far the scientific evidence has proceeded in the last decade or so. And that scientists are telling us, and they've been clamouring for many years now, saying that, look, the weight of the evidence shows that we have gone too far, that technology and industry has interfered too much with the environment, and that we may have overshot the safe limit, and that we need to start making drastic change. And that's not what governments are admitting. Governments are denying that. They're saying that we've got lots of room for manoeuvre, we need to do a couple of things and maybe mess around with carbon markets a little bit, and we'll be fine. And the scientists aren't saying that. The scientists are actually saying quite the opposite. They're saying that the policymakers aren't listening, they're not doing enough, and we need to have drastic progressive change. But that change needs to be in the interests of peoples and communities and peoples need to be galvanized and need to be involved in that process of change, rather than governments and big business dictating to us change on their terms.
And how do you respond to people that say that climate change is only due to natural variations like the sun?
Well, the issue of solar activity and its relation to climate change is something that climate scientists have known about for decades. No one denies that the sun plays a significant role in the Earth's climate change. The question is how much of a role does it play in contemporary climate change, you know, that's been going on over the last decades, if not the last century? And this is really the area of contention where you have some climate skeptics who argue that all of the current global warming that we've seen in under industrial civilization has been due to the activity of the sun. And that the radiation from the sun has basically increased, and this has basically increased temperatures on the Earth. But this is just not true. We know for a fact from numerous studies which have looked at the activity of the sun, this is a universal thing in the peer-reviewed literature, that solar activity has actually been decreasing over the last decades and has gone in completely the opposite direction to the temperature rise that we've seen. So there's no way that the sun is causing contemporary global warming.
So how would you respond to all these kind of conspiracy heads that think that, you know, climate change isn't real, it's part of a globalist conspiracy to bring about a one world government, tax the air that we breathe, all this kind of stuff?
First of all, the link between carbon dioxide emissions and heat in the atmosphere is really basic physics and chemistry. But it comes down to physics. It comes down to the way CO2 interacts with infrared light and how that can generate heat. And this is something which has been known for years. It's been known for more than a century. It goes back to before we were able to do computer models and things like that. So this is something which is really well documented in science. It's very basic. And if you take that away, that basic understanding, then you've just demolished the whole of our scientific knowledge over the last century. So it's just not plausible. So that's that, and that really is the basic kind of understanding of behind why we think that it, you know, with some level of reasonable certainty, we can say that global warming is linked to our fossil fuel emissions. And you'll always see scientists are very careful about this. You won't ever find a scientist come out and say 100%, 100%. They'll always tell you it's 95% certain, because that's the way science is. Science is based on trying to come up with the best inference that fits the data. So scientists will always tell you that this is the most probable understanding that we have. But if you kind of trying to just say that this is all a result of a globalist agenda, you know, what you're saying is that with 100% certainty, it's false. And that's not in any way scientific. There's nothing scientific about that assertion. It's pure generalisation. And it's based on a sense of paranoia, really, about the way science works. It's understandable in the sense that we can see that climate change discourse has been exploited by governments, by international institutions, especially by big business, to continue business as usual. You know, we can see this with the rise of carbon markets, with the way that companies are trying to just accelerate their profits and trying to really push the burden of the kind of changes that we need to due to climate change, pushing that burden onto populations, onto people, and trying to make them pay more, trying to make them buy more different products and all that kind of stuff. And it's understandable there's been a reaction to that. But this idea that there is this kind of that all of these scientists are part of this globalist conspiracy doesn't fit the way scientists work, the way these institutions work. You're talking about thousands and thousands of vastly disparate institutions, different individuals who have been researching these things and criticizing other research, and you know, there's this constant dialogue that goes on amongst scientists, and they don't all agree on everything that's going on in climate science. There's lots and lots of disagreements about certain things, about the way certain ecosystems work, about how fast climate change might happen, about how it's going to affect this ecosystem here. And these debates are always going on, but these scientists don't fundamentally debate these kind of basic issues of this link between carbon dioxide emissions and warming temperatures. So I think while there might be some room to say that we have doubts about maybe what some studies are saying, or we have doubts about what certain scientists are concluding about this particular issue, and we can have a debate about that, But this idea that we should just, the whole thing is a result of this globalist phenomenon, just isn't plausible. I mean, there's no evidence for that. To prove that would be an enormous feat. You'd have to kind of somehow show that there's this small, that this tiny group of people, whoever they are somehow universally funding and supporting all of these disparate institutions all over the place, which are really just, you know, you've got a whole mix of different people there working in different fields: atmospheric physics, oceanography, solar activity, and that all of these people are part of this agenda. And I just don't think that's plausible. I think, yeah, there are people who, there isn't, you know, there are small groups of people who are very powerful, who are trying to manipulate, who maybe try to manipulate national politics and manipulate media and manipulate the way people think, and they want to control people in order to benefit themselves. And then that's a phenomenon that happens, and there are conspiracies that take place. But to say that all of science is subject to that conspiracy just isn't plausible.
And so who are the people and organisations that are kind of pushing all of this stuff?
I've been following a lot of the kind of sceptic efforts to confront the idea that climate change at the moment is primarily man-made. And one of the things I want to point out is that, first of all, there's a distinction between your average person in the street who may be sceptical of some of these issues, who maybe identifies with climate scepticism, and people who, and actual sceptic movements, these organised groups of people who are often kind of small organisations which don't really have any grassroots support, which are often funded by fossil fuel interests. And one of the things I actually tried to do is actually look at some of these things, and all the time, everywhere I looked, when I looked at the groups of people who signed these petitions, apparently thousands of scientists or groups of people who have been brought together to say that we could dispute that there is a consensus, a scientific consensus about global warming and how it is. The more you look into these things, the more you find that, number one, actually, if you look at who these people are, a lot of these people aren't scientists, and if they are scientists, they're in fields which have no relevance to climate science. And it's really extraordinary. I actually went through this. It's in my book. And you go through, you know, people who are maybe engineers, maybe people who are political scientists, people who may be economists, people who are... Maybe you have people involved in, like, in physics, maybe. But very few climate scientists. In fact, you really find there are almost no climate scientists on these lists. Also, you find that the people who are there put forward as scientists often don't even have scientific credentials. A lot of them are just journalists, they're just broadcasters. And there's been a lot of disinformation, and this can actually be proven. Well, I mean, one of the guys who I looked at who's quite outspoken in galvanizing these groups in the kind of political circuits in Washington is Senator James Inhofe, who was one of the people who compiled one of the early kind of alleged lists of you know, hundreds and hundreds of scientists, not thousands of scientists, who allegedly don't believe in the kind of consensus or dispute that there is a consensus on man and global warming. And apart from the fact, I mean, number one, you look at his list and it's absurd. Most of the people on that list are not climate scientists, or they are climate scientists and their names have been put there without their consent, and they've actually been taken completely out of context. And those very scientists are writing to James Inhofe saying, can you take us off your list because we don't endorse your statement? Or you've got people who are there who are just not scientists, completely not qualified. And that's pretty much how he compiled these lists. As for who he is and his links, he was paid something like, the last time I looked, he was paid something like, over a period of a year, up to around $1 million in contributions from the oil and gas industry. This was paid, these were campaign contributions. So this guy is heavily connected to the very industries who are campaigning against climate change because they don't want us to think about alternatives. They don't want us to think about renewable energies. They don't want us to think about alternative structures that might endanger their own interests. And you find that this is overwhelmingly the case. Groups, companies like ExxonMobil, companies like BP even, have been implicated in financing a lot of the most powerful and prominent voices in the climate skeptic sphere. So I think there is a lot of reason to be skeptical of the skeptics.
We put out a thing on our Facebook and Twitter, just asking anybody if they want to ask you any questions. And one of the overwhelming big questions, as you would expect, was what are your thoughts on Coney 2012?
First impression watching the whole thing was it starts off with the planet Earth, and it's kind of a bit intriguing, slightly cheesy music in the background. And then, you know, there's a baby being born, and then it's like this little child who's playing in the sand with his dad. And then there's this guy with floppy blonde hair and glasses going on about war is bad, and then talking to people about it at various, and really apparently inspiring people. And then it eventually moves and ends with this strange plea to help people in Uganda and children in Uganda. And then it starts talking about how basically troops need to go to Uganda. And so that's a bit of a really strange trajectory to start off with this blue earth and a child being born, and then to end with that. I actually don't understand the logic. There's no logic to it. And it really is, it comes, and when you look at it like that, it comes across as a propaganda film. It really is the way that it tries to lead you from certain very positive and innocent vibes, emotions, about emotions, yeah, about, you know, children and the earth and it's all beautiful, and then suddenly leads you down this very sinister political path of encouraging military intervention.
Yeah. It's just, the point is, like, propaganda as a term, it is, has been, a lot of people use it in a very negative way, but it is actually just a term which essentially means to make something to persuade you. So a lot of people will say that our film was a propaganda film. I would suggest it's a positive propaganda film, because we're trying to say, let's make the world a better place. So if Coney's propaganda, who is it propaganda for? And what is it for?
Well, I think, first of all, to make the distinction between our kind of propaganda, if you want to put it like that, and Coney propaganda, ours is based on verifiable research. And, you know, we have a book which people can read and check it out. I think the unique thing about our film is that it's not just a film. It's a film and a book and a website, and we're constantly interacting with people, and we're going out and we're meeting people face-to-face, and we're answering questions. We're very open about it, and the book is there as well as a resource, so people can double-check and fact-check everything that we've said in the film. And no one can... So it's like, it's pretty transparent and open. So even if someone thinks what we've said is wrong, and they might disagree with it, and they might disagree with the book, but they can see that we've done research, and we've tried really hard to be pretty clear that this is how we've documented things, this is why we've reached the conclusions that we've reached. Whereas with Coney, is, you know, it's worlds apart. You know, there's leaps and bounds. A lot of it isn't even factual. It's just very, very emotional. Moving through emotional images towards this conclusion. So who does it benefit? I mean, it's interesting. It's an interesting question. But I think there is no doubt that the agenda here, I mean, once you get to the end, the agenda is very simple. The agenda is the United States should militarily intervene in Uganda. But the Ugandan people aren't going to benefit from that. They've not benefited from the last few decades of US behind-the-scenes intervention. I mean, the US defense companies sell arms to various factions in Uganda, and have done across the whole of Africa for the last, you know, ever since, you know, the Second World War. They've been doing that. So it's, you know, they're responsible for a huge conflict. We have US companies investing throughout Africa, normally to access the last West Africa. Northwest Africa is a very, very strategic supply of oil and gas reserves. And this has been flagged up by a variety of defense planning documents over the last few years, that we need to start getting some kind of involvement in West Africa. I mean, it's quite candidly admitted.
Well, John Pilger wrote, I think it was in 2011, about how, you know, it was Obama's kind of jewel was to get into Africa, and that's very well documented. You go and look at that on John Pilger's site, and it's a very well researched article.
Yeah, and the kind of the architecture of that presence in Africa, as well as in Uganda, is AFRICOM, which is kind of like the equivalent of NATO, or even almost the expansion of NATO, of having this kind of regional defense conglomerate that will ally itself with certain local friendly client regimes, doesn't matter whether they're brutal or not to their people. Again, in the name of regional security, but what you find is that AFRICOM has systematically gone into certain regions where there is mineral resources and oil and gas resources and stuff. And they've also, according to some people like Jeremy Keenan, who's a professor at SOAS, research professor at SOAS, and one of the most cited academics on North Africa, he's pointed out that AFRICOM has quite consistently... The US military has actually consistently sponsored and sided with regimes which are sponsoring criminal and terrorist groups in North Africa, including Islamist terrorist groups. So I think the overall picture is that this really does come across as a military propaganda video. It's a propaganda video that quite directly is boosting the kind of legitimacy of US intervention in Africa and giving it this very humanitarian, almost religious, pseudo-religious kind of...
They are very religious, the guys that have made it, which is not bad in and of itself, but it has coloured it, definitely. I mean, it's important. I think it is important, as I've got from you, is to be, you know, quite reasonable and say, well, look, at the end of the day, at best, it's a naive, you know, white man's guilt film student types that have made this film about this thing that they really cared about, and it just so happens they've maybe been a bit manipulated along the way, and everything they're saying in the film completely aligns itself with US foreign policy goals, you know, that's at best, and at worst it's something more sinister than that. Would you agree with that?
I don't want to say that this is a military propaganda film. I don't think it is.
Okay.
But it comes across as one, right, because of the way that it works and because of the almost Hollywood kind of production values that have gone into it, and the amount of budget they've had. It kind of comes across as a propaganda film, and because it benefits the US military, or it's kind of aligned itself with US military interests, comes across as that. But no, I don't think that this is something that the US military has funded or something. I doubt that very much. I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think that these guys, in a way, they've been exploited, or they're just naive, or they're stupid, or they're clearly uneducated. They do not understand
we'll never really know the process of how the video appeared, but we can analyze it and say, you know, it's at best, it's completely ridiculous and stupid and short-sighted.
We have to remember that it's not just kind of like people on the internet who are criticizing this, and it's been criticized by a lot of the aid agencies, and a lot of the whole international development community have been very, very wary of the whole phenomenon, because they know what's happening in Uganda. They're working on the ground. So it's a little bit of a kind of a pariah. You know, it really does not represent what humanitarian workers and relief workers and other people on the ground who are working in Africa. And some of them are, you know, funded by US government as well. You know, let's not forget USAID and stuff like that, and Department for International Development here. We have got people doing stuff in Uganda, and not all of it, that arm of the civilian government is not always doing sinister stuff. They're different bureaucratically from the military and from the military industrial complex and all the rest of it. So I think it's important to remember that there's nuances there, and these guys basically don't fit into that. They just seem to be a bunch of kids who really don't understand what's going on.
And if you go to Crisis of Civilization and share our film and you make it go as big and as viral as Kony, I promise you I will not go and wank in the street. I better maybe just do a sign off. That was maybe, probably end up cutting that out.
That's pretty funny.
That was a bit weird.
No, keep it in. It's really funny.
Okay, that's the end of episode 2. See ya. Bye.